Open Science Talk, the podcast about open science. My name is Per Pippinaspos, and today I am joined by three discussion partners, all of whom have been involved in writing a report. A very interesting report about retaining rights and open licensing in Europe, the so-called Opening Knowledge Report by Spark Europe. So the first question is to you, Vanessa Proudman. You're one of the authors. Welcome here. And first question is, what is Spark?
So Spark Europe is a Dutch foundation, and we live and breathe open in higher education. We are really focused on policy making and advocacy for open access, open science, and open education. And we serve very many stakeholders across Europe, in particular libraries, but we are working together with funders and research institutions, all to make open the default.
And you've been working there for some time?
Yes, I have actually. I think it must be over 5 years now. And certainly when I started, I thought, oh, we're going to make open the default. It won't take us too long. I love action, but there's still plenty to be done. I'm here at the Munin conference, and we still see there is still a lot of exciting work to be done in this area. And we know that there are some areas like copyright and rights retention, which really needs our attention. There are some obstacles along the way that we really need to sweep aside.
Next person on my list, author list, is you, John Treadway. Who are you?
I'm John Treadway. I'm the director of Great Northwood Consulting. So I do quite a bit of work with Spark Europe on a number of different projects. So Project Retain, which we'll talk about in a minute, is one of them, but also around open educational resources and working with the SCOTH organization that supports open infrastructure. And in other, when I'm wearing other hats, I work for a range of organizations in scholarly communication and research, like Dryad and Orchid, a number of publishers like the BMJ, some universities, a whole range of different organizations.
Lovely. And last but not least, Eva Melinchak-Slodi. Who are you?
Oh, thank you for pronouncing my surname correctly. I am a librarian, a scholarly and e-resources librarian from Zagreb University, Faculty of Humanities and Social Sciences. And I've been involved with issues related to open access for, I think, more than 20 years now, in different ways, mainly working in a library and serving needs of researchers in different ways, but also in building certain pieces of open access and open science infrastructure on an institutional level, on the national level, and in the late years also in the international level. And I've been very lucky that I've been a member of the Spark Europe board for the last 2 years, I think now. So that gave me an additional opportunity to deal with issues that I'm interested in. So,
May I also just come in? So we have three of us have been involved in this project, but there are two others who aren't with us today. One of them is Ignacy Labastida Ihuan, who's also a board member. So I have two very active board members who are passionate about copyright. So how lucky am I? So he's also been involved in this project. And we also have Clara Riera, who is involved in the community engagement in developing the action as a follow-up to this report. So we mustn't forget them today.
Yeah, and the report, let's go back to you, John. You mentioned something called Project Retain. What was that?
So Project Retain is the strand of KR21, which is focused on rights retention and open licensing. And I could try and tell you what KR21 is, but I think it's probably better that you ask Vanessa because she's so directly involved. So Project Retain was the strand of work of KR21 that led to this report.
So KR21, we're very thankful to Arcadia, the Arcadia Fund. What we really want to do with the KR21 program is to innovate copyright. So copyright reform across Europe, and one of those strands is particularly looking at rights retention, but there's also secondary publishing rights. So it's they're two sisters, if you like, two different approaches towards open access. This enables us to actually progress some of the work that we started a couple of years ago, where we actually had another report where we were looking at publisher policies across Europe, and we wanted to see whether there had been any change, and we wanted to look at other stakeholders. So we're thankful to Arcadia and to this program, and we look forward to doing more with the program in the coming months as well.
Yeah, we'll get to the futures shortly, but just to get the picture and the background right, you mentioned now rights retention, so that is part of this report, I would say part and parcel of the report even. When you mention secondary publishing rights, could you explain what that means to our listeners?
So very, very briefly, secondary publishing rights is often, you're looking at the national legislation law is developed to insist on that the author has the right to deposit a version in a repository often. So we don't want to talk about that today, but what we really want to stimulate with our work is that authors and institutions retain those rights. They are their rights, so that they can further disseminate their research where they want to be found in the future, and that they don't sign away those rights or transfer those rights or sign exclusive licenses with publishers any longer. So it's trying to educate, raise awareness, and also to really stimulate that institutions have the backs of their authors, and that we have policies in place that support our authors so that they are really encouraged to disseminate their work and that they feel safe to do so. I think the time is really right to ensure that that happens on an institutional level to really support the authors.
Maybe we could bring in you there, Eva, because you represent an institution, Zagreb University, and a country, Croatia. When we read this report, we see that there is a lot of movement in different countries in Europe. So several institutions across Europe have their own rights retention policies in place. In Croatia, how does it look there?
Well, not so bright at the moment, although I wouldn't be too pessimistic about it. But maybe just to say that it's not so much that... it's not just about Croatia. What we've seen when doing this report is that actually there are maybe two main centers of adopting institutional policies, and those are UK and then Norway, so which is something that you would know more about. But out of those countries, it is not such a broadly accepted approach among institutions, and definitely there are countries where this is even less prominent, and Croatia is one of those. And there are, I would say, different reasons. Some of those are in a way historical, and some have something to do with the current situation of the general, scholarly or scientific situation. So historically, I guess that countries of, let's say, Eastern Europe or ex-socialist countries, there were less emphasis on copyright in general and less accumulated knowledge in the institutions on how to deal with intellectual property. So although now this has changed a lot, we still don't have such level of expertise as maybe is the case in Western Europe. And the other thing is that Croatia is part of what is sometimes called scientific periphery or semi-periphery. So let's say those are the countries where it's really very important to publish more in international venues and to become more visible. And our institutions sometimes fear of lessening their chances in publishing in such international journals or something like that. So they are maybe less likely to take action if they are not certain that it will not, jeopardize their chances of getting more visibility. But things are changing in some of the countries around Croatia, for instance, in Slovenia. And Croatia is also working on some national open science plan that could move things in a different direction.
Maybe I could just add to that. I think John might tell us a little bit more about that big movement in the UK that is really stimulating so many, as well as the Norwegian case. But in the follow-up of this study, we are also going to utilise a very new network that the KR21 programme has set up of national coordinators, so national legal experts, which libraries and institutions really need to reform the legal framework that supports open science. And we have a number of countries who are keen to explore the legal context because the context is king here. It's so key to know what is possible in the particular country. As you say, in Croatia, it's a very different one. In the UK, Norway, and other countries, different. But we have interest from Finland, from Italy, from France, Spain, a number of countries across Europe who are keen to really explore this seriously. And we're really excited about that. That's also partly the point of the report, is to share some findings, show that there is a lot more room for expansion in this area. And we look forward to talking to more of those countries to see how this can be implemented, and then to share those stories out with the rest of Europe.
Yeah, just to chip in there, from Norway's side, to bring in that perspective, we did a podcast in this Open Science Talk series in January 2022, when we just adopted this policy at UiT as the first university in Norway. But in the same calendar year, all the major universities in Norway joined. So by the end of 2022, this rights retention policy was in place, which is facilitating then 100% open access from research made by Norwegian researchers if they want to, because there is also an opt-out possibility. So it's important to stress that it's the author's right to share their work in open access if they want to. So they have the freedom of choosing whatever publication venue they like, but we've also experienced people choosing Nature, which is of course a very expensive venue. If you want to make it open access with Springer Nature, you need to pay a very large fee. But then we have said to our authors, you retain your rights, we upload it in our institutional repository, the accepted manuscript version, and then that gets the green open access availability. So as far as we can tell, this is working in practice, but what we don't know is if it actually is legally possible, what we're doing. We're doing it. We haven't had a single court case yet in our country. And as far as I know, there have been no publishers on our necks either. So this is an interesting landscape where we don't know actually whether the legislation would protect the academic freedom of our researchers or not. But we hope it will, and the institutions have agreed that they will stand up for their authors in the event that there would be a legal case. Eva, you have something to add?
Well, maybe I can just say that in the report, I think that we've mentioned or explained exactly what you are speaking of. And two elements are critical here, I think. First, that institutional leaders have the appetite to do such change, even if it can be legally risky a bit. So even if you are not 100% sure that it will, because it is really hard to know until you have a court case that something is legally bulletproof. So an appetite for change and for a little bit of risk taking is important. And the other important thing is having an infrastructure that is already set and in place. So you have Christine and you have repositories and a culture of self-archiving. And that is something that's also important. So not just a policy, but also having a support and infrastructure to make it possible.
John, you were doing lots of interviews also in the preparations for this report. Do you remember from your conversations back then? This report is actually quite new. It's from June 2023, but the interviews, I guess, some time back. But can you, from the top of your head, remember this kind of discussions in with your interviewees?
Yeah, I mean, you know, we were very fortunate to interview a whole range of different people to supplement the survey that we did of institutions. A lot of analysis, and it's impossible to talk to somebody in every jurisdiction, and it's important to cover every aspect. But the thing, I mean, even related to it earlier, but the thing that stands out is how much progress has been made in the area in the UK, because there's a clear understanding of a legal basis on which it can happen. And allied with that, there was a network under the auspices of the UK Scholarly Communications License that did a lot of work seeding the possibility that essentially turned into the initiative that led to Edinburgh and Cambridge setting up their policies. And then the presence of that sort of eruption in the UK created a lot of interest in other countries, but they didn't have... So they didn't have that legal context already established. They didn't have already a network of people who've been investigating it. They didn't have... There are other aspects that it's worth pausing on. So the publishing culture in the UK is around gold open access, but the funding environment also encourages people to make their materials available via self-archiving, because it can contribute to the REF in the UK. So both of those lend themselves to institutions wanting something like a rights retention policy in place. It's similar in Norway. You have the national CRIS system, so there's a very clear place where people put materials, and so again it's a sound ground on which to build a policy of this kind, because there's a framework in place that people are familiar with that you can build it on top of. Those are the kind of things. So the legal framework, an existing network of people looking into it, the type of funding environment, the type of open access environment, those are all things that, as Eva talks about Croatia, or as we interviewed people in Italy and Denmark and the Netherlands and France, lots of interest in this, lots of potential ways forwards for these organisations to look into it, but not the same momentum or history or networks in place already. And if I may, another point I'd make is all of this, of course, builds on two other things. One is this type of policy has been in existence for a very long time. Coming out of the United States, Harvard introduced an open access policy on rights with rights retention element. I might get the year wrong, but I think it was 2008 was conceived, and it was 2011-12 that all of the different faculties in Harvard approved it. And Peter Suber, who I'm sure most of the listeners will know, continues to monitor and actively promote this type of policy. The other aspect being the funder policies around rights retention that had been in place. They evolved from, you know, Wellcome Trust policies around the types of license, the types of agreement that you should sign and retain rights, adopted and then by Plan S and by many supporters of Plan S to make funder policies. And that whole environment is what's led to interest and explosion is the wrong word, but, you know, a rapid adoption in the UK and outside, and you know, we tried to set out an analysis of all of those areas in the report. A lot of it's about institutional rights retention policies, but we spoke to a number of funders, number of institutions, and actually a number of publishers and publisher support bodies who were very keen and willing to talk to us about their experience and what they understand the legal position to be and how navigating inside publishers for those responsible for open access policy is complicated. So yeah, we did do some interviews about this and found it to be there's a danger with any report like this that you write down, this is context is really important and you must think about the context, and that doesn't tell anyone anything. But actually there's some really concrete things that help you understand why the UK is the area in which these policies have come out, why Norway is also, you know, so UK may have the most policies, but Norway is the country where all of the major institutions have a policy of this type, and it comes out of those type of things.
We'll soon talk about the future, but I see that you, Eva, have something to say.
Well, maybe just to add to what John was saying, that we saw in the report, in the investigation, that it was really a complex interplay of policies from funders, from institutions, and occasionally even from the legal system, because there are some countries where institutional policies rely on existing secondary publishing law, for instance, in Germany. And this is really important to have these incentives from the funders, but then also institutions backing up their authors to enable complying with funders' requirements. So it's not about which is more important. It's best when they work together, actually, and when they are aligned.
Yeah, and I want to come back to the point Eve's made, coming back to me, is to say, you know, talking to institutions, their motivation. So the motivation is slightly different for why do you see more policies in one place than another. Motivation to develop these policies is often to make life really simple for the researcher. So a funder policy is generally, please include a specific bit of language in any submission that you make in a publication stating that you retain your rights. That relies on an individual researcher to understand what they're doing, to put it in, to negotiate a process through submission, publication with a publisher. You know, that's complicated and it puts a burden on a researcher. The nature of particularly the UK style policy is they assert that the university has the right to put the published articles into their repository, and so the researcher in theory doesn't have to do anything else. It makes it easier, so it reduces administration. That's there. It helps them reach the long tail of authors. So for authors whose journals are, you know, in subjects where open access isn't as advanced, or where funders aren't, you know, making funds available, or where there's not necessary transformative agreements, it helps them make sure all of their articles are available. And then there is a sort of frustration about the pace of open access as well. So a desire to see it accelerate, and, you know, the gold open access approach has made a lot of progress, but actually we want to get there quicker. And this is a way that allows institutions to take it into their own hands a bit to help authors make sure everything is made open access more quickly. So just the motivation, and this, and we make some other points in the report, but those are the ones that stick in my memory from the interviews we did.
And I mean, it really is also about empowering those authors, and it's really to support the authors above all. And I was actually, I was talking to the University of Bergen last night, just picking up on what you were saying about the opt out clauses that some policies have, which is also important. And I asked them, well, how many have actually opted out? One person. So far, only one researcher had opted out. So it's quite interesting. So they were also, we were also talking about open licensing, and they're also saying that I think authors are looking for some simple, strong guidance and support from their institutions. And if you give them the guidance that this is a good way forward, don't overcomplicate things, and that then, as long as they have trust in the institution and that they have their back, they will then proceed in a positive way forward.
Yeah, the way forward. Could you expand on that? What are your next steps from Spark Europe on this?
Yes, so we're really keen to continue with this work because, as you hear, there is still a lot to do across Europe. And we're going to obviously leverage the good practices that we hear from the UK and from Norway and some other countries. So I think I've already said we're going to explore other countries and showcase some of those. Also have further webinars, bringing those policymakers together to discuss what are some of those success factors and what have been some of those struggles. But what we're also doing right now is we're also trying to raise awareness of the topic. Not everybody is ready to read a 100-page report. So we created a one-pager, an infographic. We had a two-week Twitter campaign raising awareness amongst different stakeholders, some simple information, some more sophisticated. We had some discussions also online. And what we've also done is, from the learnings from our interviews, we've brought that together to create some guidance for national policymakers who would like to implement a rights retention strategy, which Slovenia has done. We are so thrilled about that, seeing that policy, and hope that others will take that forward. But we also have checklists for institutional policymakers, and we also have some guidance for publishers. So we've digested a lot of those good practices and we've got the 5 steps for the publishers and the 6 steps for the institutional policymakers. And we will adjust those over time. So I think it's important that from all of the knowledge that we've gathered, and we understand not everybody's ready to read that report, we've brought it together into some bite-size, hopefully, knowledge that will help others. But I think our challenge is, how do we reach everybody who needs to know, right, and the policymakers? So we're trying to circulate this. So the more people who share our resources, their own practices, we encourage more conversations like this to happen and to share those good practices out. So to create a movement, this movement in the UK, we love seeing that because, you know, many working together, we're much stronger that way, but we need that energy across Europe as well. So we will contribute to that going forward in the next months. And we're also keen to hear from the communities, what else can we do to support you in supporting your authors and in setting up an institutional policy across Europe.
With that, I thank you all for coming to this podcast and wish you a safe trip home from Tromsø. Open Science Talk is produced by the University Library of UiT, the Arctic University of Norway. Thanks for listening.